No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to all of, us and affect our lives. Feel free to be part of the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. We have a special guest with us tonight, but first and foremost, let me say hello to Maria. Maria, how are you?
Very well. Thank you, Michael. And you and your family?
We're doing great. And how are things in California?
We're on fire and we're sizzling. And climate change is like, I don't know how anybody, well, it's just like the people who won't get vaccinated. It's here. I mean, our fire season, we used to have a season and now it's almost all year long. And it's just, it's terrible. And if we don't do something soon, our planet is never going to recover.
I know, it's really horrible, and we're going to, in a few weeks, maybe we'll have the organizers of our march for Martin Luther King's, for the March on Washington anniversary, 58th anniversary, we're going to do a march, and it's about D.C. statehood, green jobs, and justice. So green jobs and justice are very much a part of it, and we have several national environmental groups that are involved. And you're right, we got to do something, or we're going to lose it all. Before we get started, let me just send out condolences. Bob Moses, who was a civil rights leader in America, died over the weekend, and our condolences go out to him and his family. He was an icon. But today we have with us a very special guest, Jeff Foster, and Mr. Foster is a teacher, or was a teacher. I'm not sure if he still teaches at Marjory Stoneman and Douglas High School. He was there in February 2018 when they had the horrible massacre that we all remember, and he's written a book called For Which We Stand, How Government Works and Why It Matters, and he's motivated the children from Marjory Stoneman and Douglas to have meetings with government people in Tallahassee and also in Washington, D.C. And they put together one of the most amazing marches I've ever been to, which we'll talk about in a minute, the March for Life, which they did in March 2018, right after, it was shortly after that tragedy that they were still trying to recover from. So let's get Mr. Foster on the show and discuss what happened. Mr. Foster, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And I am still an educator at Stoneman Douglas High School. This will be year 22. We begin in about 2 weeks. I'm finishing up my summer session right now, actually.
Are you going to be in person, Mr. Foster?
That's we think so. With our governor, Governor DeSantis, I mean, he's, now he's starting to preach the vaccine to people, unfortunately about a year too late. But we're supposedly going back full bore. There's been a couple meetings. My wife teaches in Palm Beach County. I teach in Broward County, and the leaders haven't made decisions yet, but it looks like it's going to be mask optional in school, which is kind of scary because similar to your state, Maria, which is on fire. We're on fire with COVID down here in Florida again. We have the highest rate in the country right now in terms of number of cases. And frankly, we're a little scared. So, I mean, I don't know how it's going to work. I mean, last year was awful, but at least we were in no danger in the school because we were mostly remote. I had out of the 222 students I had, I think I had six show up in person, and everything else was done remotely. This year, there's no remote being offered as of this moment, and we're going to be, you know, shoving 37 in my class, and, you know, with mask optional, it's going to be a scary proposition.
I think I read that Florida has 20% of all the cases in the United States.
That's what I'm reading. I don't know how.
That's staggering.
It's very
especially
staggering.
Especially since you don't have the population that, say, New York and California do.
I think it's at 63,000 cases last week or last month. The numbers are not as accurate as they've been because Governor DeSantis, and he's done some decent things for our state, but in COVID, I haven't been a massive fan of his. He stopped doing a daily count now, so we do counts like weekly or every 2 weeks now, so we don't know how accurate the counts are anymore, but there's no question the state is definitely going in the wrong direction, and it's frightening. You know, you go out to a store, and we don't have mask mandates anymore. My family, we still wear them. I have a pre-existing condition. We're all vaccinated, but I still wear them, and you go to a grocery store, and anywhere from a quarter to a half of the people have masks. And again, people are respectful of each other, and I haven't seen any, you know, of the horrors I've seen on some of the internet where people are spitting on each other and screaming at each other. So it's civil, but it's still, you know, it's a little alarming when you go out and there's a lot of people and you just continue to hear these cases just continue to go up and up. And as you guys have noticed, I'm sure nationally too, it's the younger crowd that's getting it now.
Well, and yeah. I live in Los Angeles County. And we've got the mask mandate, but I straddle another county and they don't have the mask mandate. Mm-hmm. So it depends on where you go, where you shop, where you dine, whether or not you wear one. And like you, I'm double vaccinated and I still mask because 20% of double vaccinated people or 20% of the Delta variant are being by double vaccinated people. So we're not out of harm's way. 20%, odds that I don't want to gamble with.
You know, the good news is we're probably not going to perish and we're probably not going to end up in the hospital, but still, I don't want to get COVID.
Correct.
You know, I don't want to put my youngest daughter in danger who's unable to get vaccinated right now. I have a 10-year-old, a soon-to-be 10-year-old, next week's her birthday, actually, that's, you know, unable for another 5 years to get vaccinated. I mean, I assume they're going to hopefully get it for younger kids by the beginning of next year, but, you know, she's had many of her friends, you know, that she, you know, dances with, et cetera, that have got COVID already. And again, they're not really in a high risk factor, but still, it's still the spread of the variant. It's scary.
Yeah, you know, and I don't want to digress too far into this conversation, but I've got one thing I've got to say. Florida, of all the places, you know, my first job out of college, I worked in Florida. There's a lot of old people in Florida. You know, aren't they the most vulnerable, not only the most, one of the most vulnerable populations out there? And to have this happen in an area where people are so vulnerable is really, really amazing to me. Let me ask you about that terrible day in February 2018. It must be horrible to do what you do, to be a teacher, and to have to experience something like this with young people. You know, when I went to high school, my high school was the place that I felt safest. All my friends were there. You know, there were a bunch of people that we called teachers who were there looking after us, right, and trying to move us in the right direction. It was as much a social place for me as in fact, for me, unfortunately, it was more of a social place than it was an educational place.
For all of us, I think.
You know, but we were so comfortable there. And to have it so horribly desecrated and invaded violated, yeah, it must just have been a horrible experience for you as a teacher.
May I, before you answer that part of the question, could you walk us through what that day was for you?
Yeah, please.
Sure. Yeah. As Senator Ralph said, I mean, you know, we have mass shooting drills now, even before the shooting happened at my school, and we have safe places and everything else. So we've been, you know, doing them. And actually that morning, believe it or not, the second period of the day, we did an evacuation drill. This was a fire drill evacuation. And we had been told that year that we're going to get a lot more, I don't want to say intense, but we're going to have a lot more of the mass evacuation drills, the mass shooting drills. and we can expect them at any time. So later in the day, at approximately, you know, just after 2 o'clock, about 30 minutes before the bell was to ring to end the day, the alarm went off again, and that alarm was set off because we had the shooter on the other side of campus. Our campus is very large. It's been compared to our college campus. We have 13 different buildings. I mean, a massive wow. campus we have. And so when we heard it in my building, which is the 300 building, which is, I would say, we were in no danger of direct danger at that moment, but we had no idea there was a shooting going on. We kind of looked at each other like, wow, another drill? This is crazy. So, you know, I personally and my other colleagues in my hallway said, kids, let's grab our stuff. This could be, take us to the end of the day. You know, this has to be, you know, real, some kind of fire or something, or maybe, you know, maybe the chef lit a fire in our classroom and it went off, whatever it might be. So we walked downstairs. By the time we were downstairs, one of my neighbors at school heard gunfire, and by then we started moving a little quicker, and then we saw there were a lot of police on campus, and really, we still weren't sure if we were in a drill until about probably 5 or 6 minutes after it started. I guess it broke on the news through kids calling their parents and saying what was going on.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it seemed like I hate to use the word surreal, but mm-hmm. every phone, I was around probably 10 or 15 teachers on the side of the school being evacuated, probably with about 400 to 500 kids in front of us. We were at the back, obviously, the end of the line, you know, pushing it out down this corridor outside. And all the phones rang, and my personal phone, my brother called me and said, are you okay? And I said, what do you mean? He's like, there's been a shooting at your school. It was like every kid, every teacher in my general area were all on their phones at the same time. Like we all got the news almost like collectively at once. And it just became chaos, and kids just started sprinting, you know, in the direction we were going and jumping fences. And we just kind of, me and my colleagues would kind of stay back and just made sure everybody was safe in our area. And eventually we evacuated out to the front of the school or the side of the school. And by then the amount of police and emergency vehicles that were going 80 miles an hour down a 20 mile an hour, 2-lane street, they were innumerable. And we were just literally, because kids were almost like zombies, like walking back towards the school, you know, to kind of see what was going on. And we just kind of got everybody out of the way. And then, unfortunately, you know, we managed to migrate across the street to a local eatery, me and about 10 or 12 colleagues. And over those next 4 or 5 hours, guys, I mean, we got phone call after phone call. There was false reports about people that have been shot, people that have been killed, colleagues, kids, et cetera. We were watching the newscast that was on there, and they kept updating the numbers. I think it started with 5, and as you guys know, eventually went to 17. And the rest of the day, you know, we just kind of sat there over the next 5 to 6 hours. Some of my friends were there for, you know, over another 12 hours. It was a lot of the debrief happened at one of the hotels around the corner, and didn't get home until 1 or 2 a.m. My wife managed to get through all the roadblocks, saying that she had her husband that was, you know, she wanted to pick up her husband that worked in a school, and she drove home 5 of my friends that work with me. Mm. And, you know, I went home, went to sleep, you know, didn't want to watch anything, you know, I don't remember really sleeping. But then when I woke up and put on my phone and saw the various messages, because by then, you know, news was coming out about who the people were that had perished the night before and who had got, you know, who were wounded the day before. So we started to put the pieces together. Then after that, we were just constantly in motion. I mean, I think it was that afternoon, the next day, was the vigil down the street from our school, which precipitated the beginning of the March for Our Lives and the kids getting together and the organizing to go to Tallahassee. And it was just one thing after another. And then unfortunately, in between, you know, all the events that we did to try to change policy, we had to go to a bevy of funerals. And that was just awful. I mean, every time I say it, I just got a chill on my spine now. I mean, it was like we had an Excel spreadsheet. I mean, this was really the only way you could do it, that was sent out from the school basically detailing, you know, 8 a.m. this funeral, 10 a.m. this funeral, with the location and the city. And you tried to go to as many as you could, the ones that you knew, the ones that your friends knew, the ones that you needed to support your colleagues at, because it was, you know, there were 3 faculty that died and 14 children that died, and then 17 that survived the shooting that had various, you know, degrees of injuries. And then really over the, you know, just in those days afterwards, sort of getting together with your friends and even the students, because, I mean, we saw kids, you know, that next day at this vigil, there were thousands of people at this vigil. And you were just hugging people, and they were just so happy you're alive, is what we were saying to each other. And you sort of pieced together what happened. And obviously, you know, over time, we sort of got the whole, you know, day by day blow of what occurred and through all the investigations and everything else. But you were just consumed by it, you know, because that's all you could be, because that was your life. That was your school. And we didn't know if we were ever going to go back. We didn't know if we were ever going to be safe. And here we are 3+ years later, and we just graduated the final class that experienced the shooting. The freshmen from that year just graduated, you know, a couple weeks ago. And now, you know, this year we were all hoping, the staff at least, was going to be a little bit different, because this will be the first year that we'll actually be in the school, and the only ones that it will have gone through, you know, the incident will be the staff that still remains at the school, which isn't that many. You know, a lot of us have moved on to different schools or different careers or just moved out of the state completely, but there is still a decent core of us that are still at the school. And, you know, not that we were looking forward, but it was going to kind of be nice to almost get a fresh start. And then obviously COVID happened, which ruined these poor kids' lives for the last year and a half. So this last class had a brutal 4 years of high school. I would argue it's probably the worst 4 years of any kid could ever have in high school, this last group of seniors who just went through. They had one, like, regular semester of high school, and the rest was, you know, either defined by the shooting or by COVID. So, yeah, they're a tough group for sure.
Wow, and all of that attention.
Well, let me ask you, what was the mood of the students, you know, once you'd been through that initial period of shock? Where,
you know, the hardest thing, Senator, I think was, you know, when we went back that year, I think we were out for about anywhere from 7 to 10 days. Again, the numbers, you know, elude me, but I think it was probably a week and a half we were out. And we went back on a Sunday and had sort of a meet and greet at the school, which was a really good idea. I don't know who came up with that idea, but all the parents brought their kids back to the school, went back to their individual classes, you know, said hi to the teachers. The parents were hugging us for, you know, saving their kids' lives, whether we directly did or didn't. I mean, they just wanted someone to hug. They just know that their son or daughter survived, and they were in your class, and they wanted to thank you, and you gave them a hug and said, you know, you're welcome, even though, you know, all you did was mark. But still, whatever it was. And for that first month and a half, really all we did was just kind of sit around, and we had counselors everywhere. We really didn't do much work. I mean, that was sort of, you know, on the advice of the county and all the counselors. We did some work, but very little. A couple of us, including myself, had to pick up some of the classes of the kids that, you know, lost their teachers. So, you know, my friend Scott Beagle in my department was one of the ones that was murdered that day. And so I had one free power, so I picked up one of his classes and, you know, had to introduce myself to those kids and try to build a relationship with them for the last couple months of the year. And really, you know, I was working in earnest to try to help, you know, get as many kids as possible that were interested in going to the march, And, you know, we had buses donated. We had planes donated from American Airlines. And we got thousands of our students to D.C. for free travel and lodging to go to the march. So that was a full-time job. You know, I was working along with Emma Gonzalez, who was one of our, you know, ones that became, you know, sort of a well-known name after the event. And her and I would get together about every 2 or 3 days. She was in my class. Most of those kids were in my class that year. But Emma would come to my class at the end of school, and I would throw her in my car, and we'd go across the street to a meeting place, whether it be a hotel or a park. And we would basically, like, hold court and answer questions to any parents or kids that were interested in going and talking about the logistics and what the goal was and everything else. And it was a nice distraction, you know, the Tallahassee trip and the Washington trip. But again, we were motivated to change laws that hopefully would prevent this from happening again. And as we talked about before, unfortunately, it still is occurring way too often, gun violence in America, but we're still out there trying to do things. I mean, I currently sit on a committee called Ban Assault Weapons Now, and we tried to get a ballot initiative in the Florida legislature last time, and we came up short in the Supreme Court, the final step to get it on the ballot last November. So we're trying again, you know, in a year and a half to get it back on there again. So we're still fighting, and we're still trying to get common sense gun laws passed. But, you know, and then honestly, the next year was probably harder because we had all sorts of false alarms in the school the next year. We had fire alarms going off. We had some kids literally pulling the fire alarm, thought it was funny, and kids were just under their desk shaking. So the next year was really,
goodness.
Yeah, it was horrible. It was horrible. I mean, you know, we use the word, when I say we, you know, collectively sort of the school, the staff, it's an unimaginable situation, and we all get together, and, you know, we're bonded together forever, and we're you know, we look out for each other, but it was difficult. And, you know, and how do you tell a a parent that calls you that says, hey, little Jeff didn't study for your test because he was up all night shaking in his bed. You can't say, oh, too bad. He's got to take it. So we had to do, obviously, you know, we were very conciliatory when it came to kids, you know, needing to go speak, because we still have, I don't know how it'll be this year, but for the last 3 years, we've had two portables that were dedicated just to counseling for the event and all sorts of things. You know, the smallest of things can trigger any one child, and it's impossible to understand what that could be because, you know, stuff has happened to me out and about, and I'm like, wow, I can't believe that just made me think about what happened that day. So, yeah, it's been a trying couple of years. The kids, like I said, are very resilient. Most of them have, I don't want to say moved on, but they move on to the next step of their life, but I'm sure they're always going to carry that day with them, and we're always going to remember the 17 we lost. And again, everybody's still striving to do things to try to prevent it from happening. You know, that's the mantra. Let's pray that Stoneman Douglas doesn't happen again. But unfortunately, as you guys are well aware, it seems to happen every month and a half, whether it's at a school, at a mall, on a drive-by, whatever it would be. And it's a shame that this country has come to this now.
Well, you know, I was at the March for Our Lives, and I go to a lot of marches. It's a lot of what we do in our fight to get equal rights here in the District of Columbia.
Sure.
And it was an amazing march. Not only was it amazing because so many people showed up. I mean, so many people. You know, as far as the eye could see in every direction in front of the Capitol. But also the energy that was there with so many young people. You know, I'm old enough that I marched in protest against the Vietnam War when I was a teenager down on the Mall. But it didn't have the same kind of energy that march had. That march, it was just phenomenal on every level. So how hard was that to get everybody motivated and to get them all?
You know,
I mean, to do it in a month,
right,
is just an amazing
the timing
amazing
in and of itself.
Yeah.
I think
March
that surprised us more than anything. Go ahead.
It was a month and 10 days afterwards, and it was an aggressive date. There's no question about it. But I think it really shows, and this is if the march showed anything, it showed the ability of not only young people, but anybody who has, you know, savvy when it comes to social media to be able to organize. And if you strike the right chord, you know, as Roy Hobbs said in the baseball movie, people will come, you know. So, I mean, and that's what happened. It was unbelievable. I mean, you know, we woke up, we were there for the 3 or 4 days previous and did a lot of events. And, you know, we knew the celebrity that were there, and, you know, and we knew that was going to help, you know, to have the, you know, the Oprahs and the Ellen DeGeneres and the George Clooney's and even the Kardashians. I mean, anybody, you know, that was anybody wanted to be there that day for the right reasons. And that motivates people to show up. I mean, we can see that the way the social media pulls people. I mean, I watch my daughter, you know, on TikTok 24 hours a day, basically. I have to pull her off that thing. So, I mean, they're motivated by that. And, yeah, it was when we woke up early that morning to march from our hotel. We were staying right next to where the Washington Wizards play. I think it's the Marriott right there. And we walked to the Capitol, and it was really early. And, you know, but we already saw people lining up. And by the time, you know, we were backstage, the five I was with, because, you know, obviously I was involved. And, you know, once we got through and we were kind of hanging out in the tents for a little bit in the back, because it was nice that day, but still we wanted to be seated because we knew it was going to be a long day. And we started to walk out maybe about an hour before the march started. And we just looked down the street. We were like, oh my God. I mean, you couldn't see, you know, it was just an ocean of people. It was unbelievable the amount of people that were there. And the speeches were great. The performances were great. You know, the energy of the crowd, like you said, was great. And that's what's been a little disheartening, that we haven't had this massive change, because you would think that stuff like that would motivate everybody just to be like, all right, let's just get, you know, background checks. Let's just get, you know, longer waiting periods. Let's get rid of bump stocks. It just seems like simple things, but like everything else in D.C., like everything else in Tallahassee, like everything else in Sacramento, you know, people just want to line up opposite of you. You know, they can't, there's no negotiation anymore. It's either my way or the highway. And they think, you know, you say, oh, I want a background check. So like, oh my God, you're not taking my guns. Second Amendment. It's like, that's not what we're trying to do, but that's the America we live in now. And it's unfortunate, but, you know, all I can do is an educator. And the main reason, you know, that I was asked to write the book and willingly wrote the book was to try to, you know, ensure that, that younger people from the very beginning understand what the country is about, how the government works, and really the most important part is how they can get involved. And we saw that day the power that the youth can have in terms of you know, informing, you know, the people and really the electorate, you know, to how they can make a difference. And I hope still long term we will make a difference. But it's an uphill battle in 2021, that's for sure.
And to that end, though, let's speak about your relationship with and let our listeners know what the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act is.
It's unfortunately it was passed, and we did get stricter background checks, and we did get rid of bump stocks. But then the Governor DeSantis and the legislature really didn't enforce that act. So by the time it was passed and being applied, it really, you know, it doesn't have much teeth anymore, honestly, like a lot of laws, like a lot of executive actions that happen. So, I mean, you know, laws, as the Senate knows, and I'm sure you know as well, Maria, are only as strong as those enforcing it. And, you know, if it's not being followed, and again, they've whittled it down to almost nothing, and it's pretty much carte blanche. You can buy anything in Florida with very little restrictions still when it comes to gun laws.
It's horrible.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we see this. You know, we had Kathleen Kennedy Townsend on a few weeks ago on the anniversary of the assassination of her father. And we talked about 1968 and what a horrible year it was and how many civil rights and other leaders we lost in that period. And one of the questions I asked her is, has this become the new way that we vent our frustration, that people don't attack leaders anymore? They walk into a shopping center, they walk into a school, or they walk, you know, into a public place and just murder people. It's it really is something that we need to get on top of. And here in D.C., we're just having a horrible time. We had a six-year-old killed with a stray bullet the other day. And you know, we've all seen these incidences, like the one in Southern California, right, Maria, where the woman was driving down the highway and pissed somebody off, and they shot in the car and killed her little boy.
Yep.
You know,
she gave him the finger, apparently.
She gave him the finger. Yeah. A man. You know, I mean, really, it's really frustrating to have to deal with this stuff. And like you say, Mr. Foster, no movement. You know, hardly any movement on the spectrum, even though we know things like the fact that the majority of gun owners want background checks.
Yes.
It's not, you know, it's just a hostile few that don't. And there's something that's changed in our society. And I don't know if social media is to blame. Maybe you have a better insight on that dealing with young people. But when I was a kid, I had access to guns. Every boy I knew had access to guns. Our fathers fought in the Second World War. But nobody ever thought about going into a high school and murdering a bunch of kids. Yeah. We never heard of things like this.
I don't know when that is. I don't know when that has changed. I don't know if that's because of movies, because of video games, because, I mean, there's been studies on all that stuff, and I don't know what is the reason. But yeah, like you said, I mean, whether it's walking into the bar in California a couple of years ago, or walking into my school, or just driving down the street. I mean, I had an incident a couple of years ago. I was with my family driving back from a birthday party on a Sunday, where I was on I-95 going home, and a car pulled up next to, like, we were in the third, like, first lane. We both tried to move to the second lane together. We saw each other, and we kind of went back off, and I kind of gave him, like, the high side, like, sorry, brother. And he pulled up next to me, rolled out his window. He had a gun. The pastor had a gun in his hand. I just hit the brakes and just slowed down. I'm like, are you kidding me? You know? I'm
wow.
Like, so, yeah. Oh, yeah. And my heart was thumping. Thank God my wife was asleep. My kids were, like, passed out in the back seat. But I was like, I cannot believe it. That's just broad daylight on a Sunday. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
But it's
for something
the violent
so important.
And you know, and I think, you know, you ask what the reason is. I mean, there's a lot of irresponsible people out there, you know, in the world, in journalism, that have blogs, et cetera, that perpetuate a lot of this stuff. And you can find, whatever audience you want, and you can speak to whatever audience you want, and you can, you know, rile up whatever audience you want. You know, I mean, like even people that saying that our school was like, I read a story the other day. I don't know if you guys got this out where you are, but obviously we got it here because it's in our community, where one of the fathers of one of our students thought that his son, he can't understand why his son still feels the way he feels about the shooting, because he thought it was a false flag event that had never happened. And he's trying to convince his son that the Stoneman Douglas shooting didn't happen, even though the kid was in school that day. That's how bad that is.
Wow.
We have a father of one of our students. Imagine, I mean, try to wrap your head around that. I don't know what he is listening to, but yeah, there's an actual father of one of the kids that lives in the house with the child that went through the shooting at MSD that's trying to convince his son that it was a government conspiracy made up and no one died that day.
Like Sandy Hook.
So, yeah. Correct. And we were, I spent a lot of time with a lot of parents from there, because unfortunately we're all intertwined now, Columbine and Sandy Hook and us. And yeah, I mean, when that happened years ago, and I was teaching at the time at Douglas, you know, I told the kids, again, I teach politics, obviously. I said, if this doesn't bring, you know, action to change gun laws, nothing will. And I wish I could say I wasn't surprised, but I wasn't surprised. I mean, like everything, you know, everybody was up front saying, we're going to do something. And then as the months went by and the wheels started going into motion, it all just kind of faded and we moved on to the next, you know, the next event, the next story. And when I saw that happen at Sandy Hook, that's, you know, it didn't obviously dissuade us from doing what we did, but I haven't been surprised, unfortunately, that we haven't been able to change policy, because it's tough to do anything, even something that seems like Senator Brown said, I think it's 90-some-odd% of people are for background checks. And we can't even get that passed, which is just wild.
Well, so,
I was going to ask, if you don't mind, since, Senator, you're in the middle of politics, and based on what Mr. Foster just said, why are we just stuck? Is it the NRA at the end of the day, or is... what is it about politics that doesn't create movement in this regard?
Well, I think it is in part, you know, with the NRA, they have money and they have people. I mean, if I could tell the young people of America to do something, I would say all those little events you have to raise money for your local Kiwanis Club and for kids recreation programs and things like that, somebody should band all the high school kids in America together to raise money and go after some pro-gun politician and put money in a race against somebody who stands
up. We've done that.
Yeah, because...
We've been successful with some of that, but I think... Really, yeah. The larger issue, I think, is the constituency. I think the Republican Party specifically is scared to death to embrace any of this because they feel like they're going to lose elections. And that's what it comes down to.
That's exactly. You know, we had, look, I worked for years with the senator from Virginia, Mark Warner. And, you know, he was... he's a kind of a classic liberal guy. We couldn't get him to sign on to our bill to make DC a state. He ultimately did, but for years we fought with him to get him on the bill because the NRA was against the bill. And he would say to us very candidly, you know, that his people would say to us very candidly, look, the National Rifle Association is big in Virginia and they don't like the bill. And Mark is for reasonable gun control, but he can't come up against the NRA.
And finally
he did. But finally he stood up. And you know, they're scared. Politicians are scared. I mean, you know, I don't think most people grasp the idea that if you're a member of Congress, every 2 years, imagine this, every 2 years, you not only need to go up for a job review in front of your peers, but you need to go up for a job review in front of everybody you ever worked for. You know, just imagine if you were a teacher, for example, in Florida, and you not only had to go to the principal and the administrator in school, but every teacher in the state of Florida got to to decide sure. whether you kept your job or not. These guys, you know, they're like, you know, hamsters in a python cage. They're always yep. nervous. They're always afraid. And a very wise politician told me very early on, there's only two things you can do to a politician. You can either hurt them or help them. So you got to figure out a way to do one of those two things to get them to move. Not going to get them to move unless you can help them or you can hurt them. And, sure. and you know, I mean, children are a powerful tool. They really can be, and you know, in a lot of political causes. But, you know, we should talk about this, Mr. Foster, how hard it is to organize them because they have lives. You know, right? Yep. They have, yes. they're growing. They have other things that they need to be involved in. And so to get them to be a consistent force in politics cannot be an easy thing. So,
well, and they're minors.
And they're minors, right?
Right.
They don't vote.
Right.
So, you know, so they don't have any capital, really. But let me ask you, is that what motivated you to write the book? How did
it truly is. I think the younger, you know, this book is geared towards, you know, upper elementary school through high school. It's marketed to third through eighth grade. But I mean, I have friends who teach with me. I teach advanced placement classes, but I have friends that teach, you know, regular honors classes in my school. Like, I want to use your book as my textbook for seniors. And like, it's basically everything I teach just in smaller digestible form for a younger audience. And the goal is, you know, I figure if kids can be exposed to this at an early age, because I don't know if you guys are aware, I'm sure you are, that a lot of school districts don't have civics education.
Yeah,
except in high school. Except in high
yeah,
school. I mean, it's the most important thing we do as citizens. We control our republic. And I want kids to, when Scholastic asks me, I'm like, heck yeah, I'm going to do this because I want kids to at least be exposed to this. And that's been the most heartening thing is so many people I know said they're laying up at night and reading it with their 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds. And the more they see and the more they're exposed to it, they can come, you know, be like, you know, Yolanda Renee King wrote the foreword to my book, Martin Luther King Jr.'s granddaughter, and she's, I believe, 11 or 12. I think she might have just turned 12. And to see someone like that who's already out there, you know, trying to emulate her grandmother and grandfather, what they're doing, you could have an influence because obviously, you know, we can see what we've had at the March for Our Lives and we can motivate older people to say we should take care of this younger generation. So I think, you know, with this book, I mean, again, you don't have to read it all at once. It's in easy digestible parts just to expose children to our republic and for them to understand how things work, that by the time they get to a voting age or really by the time they get to where they can drive and organize and be on social media, they can take interest in whether it's the environment or whether it's gun laws or whether it's registering people to vote or whether it's helping their father become mayor or mother become city commissioner or mother become governor. I mean, just whatever it might be, just understand that that is the most important thing we have as citizens of the United States is our voice. And if we can amplify that voice by bringing more people to the table, maybe that will make that congressman or senator that Senator Brown mentioned, you know, say, oh, they're going to hurt me. Maybe I want to pay attention to what they're saying now. So that's the goal is to multiply the voices of the youth. You know, forever the youth has been ignored because the youth does not participate. That's starting to slowly change. And I think the more exposure they have at a younger age, the more likely they are to say when they turn 18, or like I said before, even before 18, say, hey, I want to go to this march. I want to participate in this function. I want to, you know, do whatever. We have 16, 17, 18-year-old kids running for mayor and city commissioner
right.
in cities and actually winning now, which is awesome.
Right. Awesome. It's awesome. And you know what? There's a very famous, just to show you how powerful people, how children can be, there's a very famous story about a Boy Scout leader who took a bunch of kids to the Lincoln Memorial, and he talked about how Dr. King had given his I Have a Dream speech from the steps of the memorial and how it changed the civil rights movement in America. And one of the kids said, well, how come there's no plaque or memorial to that if it was so important? And the teacher said, I don't know. The Boy Scout leader said, I don't know. And he researched it and he found out that there was a law that says you cannot put a memorial or any kind of dedication on a memorial that already exists. And he said, wow. That's the law. And the kid said, well, that's not right in this case. And he said, let's change it. So they went before the Senate. They lobbied a bunch of senators. And the one senator who sponsored the bill that ultimately changed it so they could put a plaque up said in a press conference, he said, I thought the kids were wrong. I don't think you should be able to do that. But I just didn't know how to say no to a bunch of shiny-faced young, you know, kids
right.
in Boy Scout uniforms. I couldn't figure out how to say no to them. and that really is their power, right? To
right.
stand up publicly. Some of those kids I heard speak on that day. It's not that they were the very best speeches I've ever heard, but they were given with such passion, and yeah. it came so much from inside those children that you would have to be a soulless creature to stand there and listen to them and not be moved. I think that's really the power they have. Go ahead, Maria. I'm sorry. Give
me Well, Mr. Foster, one of your quotes resonates with me when you say, if you don't participate, you can't complain.
Yeah.
And I always say that to adults. If you didn't vote, I don't care what your opinion is.
Right.
I don't want to have a conversation with you.
I mean, it truly is.
Yeah. It's like, no, you don't get to have an opinion if you don't vote.
I tell my kids that every day, the first day, throughout the entire year, and the last day. I'm like, you know, and whether we're registering voters or I'm going with a group of kids to vote for the first time or I'm sponsoring a club or going to some kind of meeting with them. Yeah, like you said, whether it's Kiwanis, whatever it might be, I'm
yeah.
always there to help out. And what's cool is a lot of the staff at our school is like that now. I mean, obviously we were all, you know, affected the same way, but I was that way beforehand. But obviously I'm doubly that now because we have so many kids now that want to participate, that have brothers and sisters. And it's awesome. It's a great thing. And it's heartening because there's people out there everywhere in every walk of life, whether it be celebrities, whether it's just be local people reaching out. I mean, we have people, you know, donate stuff to us. We have people reach out to us. We have people make stuff for us. I mean, there's so much love out there. That's why it brings me such angst to realize we just can't come together as a nation and do like simple things, because when people, you know, are in trouble, we've shown that we can rally as a nation, whether it's 9/11, whether it's wildfires, whether it's whatever, you know. You see these little kids doing things for families during COVID that yeah. have been amazing around yeah. the country. So that's what that's what I try to tap into. And that's what I try to tell them all the time, guys. You know, it's real easy to just burrow and do nothing. But, you know, if you do that, you have no right to complain about anything. I mean, I had a group of kids a few years ago that were tired of the school lunch. I said, well, let's start a petition to bring in Chick-fil-A into the school then, you know, or bring in McDonald's into the school, or bring in, you have the power to do that, you know, get a petition nice. Going, present it to the principal, might work, might not work. And
right.
unfortunately it did not work, but I mean, that's what you need to do. You need to petition, you know, your government, whether it be your school board, whether it be, you know, the congressman, senator, governor, et cetera, to try to get stuff done. And I think the one thing I try to point out in the book as well, that a lot of people are unaware of, although I think they're a lot more intimately aware of this now because of COVID, is your local government has a major impact on
yes.
your daily lives. You know, everybody
yes.
knows who the president is and understands that,
mm-hmm.
but nobody knows who their city commissioners and mayors and,
right.
and councilmen mm-hmm. and women are. And they've made, you know, whether it's the mask mandate, whether it's online learning, whether, you know, whatever it might be, those are the people that are making those decisions, not President Biden, not President
mm-hmm.
Trump. So
mm-hmm.
I think people are intimately aware now that local government matters, and maybe we can get more than, you know, 10% of people showing up to local elections now.
Yeah. Well, you know, and those people are even more responsive to things like children. They're even
sure.
more, it's even harder for them to say no to children. One of the things that caught me, my attention, was the name of your book, For Which We Stand. I quote the Pledge of Allegiance all the time. The end of
right.
The end of the Pledge of Allegiance is liberty and justice for all, which really doesn't exist here in Washington, D.C. So that really struck me about the book. Tell me, how can we get the book? How can people let our listeners know how they can get the book?
It's published through Scholastic. It's available on their website. It's available on Amazon. Every major outlet that sells books, it's available. And I mean, my hope now that it's been doing very well. Obviously, we dealt with COVID last year in terms of getting it into different school districts, but I'm hoping this year. I can get into a lot more school districts. And I said before, I'm hoping we get civics education in the more school districts too. I mean, even if it's just once a week in elementary school, once a week in middle school, the more exposure they have to this, the more likely they are to participate in the future. And again, that's my calling as a teacher, is to try to get, you know, every person that I, you know, touch along my way to say, hey, we have power. You can do things. Don't bitch about it. Make stuff happen. And that's the goal.
So, well, I just want to go
ahead. Well, the irony of this all in the harmonic convergence, in my estimation, and perhaps you can speak to this, is the woman that your school is named after, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, who lived to be 108 years old, who was a rabble rouser, who was a suffragette advocate, a journalist. I mean, way before her time, really, when you think about it. And then she spent most of the latter part of her life advocating for the Everglades. And we were talking about climate change and global warming and all of that. She did all of that. And here you are with her as a legacy at the school that you teach this at. How beautiful is that?
It's incredible. And our school is actually located right on the Everglades, like right on the edge of the Everglades. So, and that's what she fought to preserve all those years. The Everglades is still, preservation is almost completely owed to her. Yes. And it's an incredible thing. And you're right. She lived to 108, and you're right. She went from the 20s as a suffragette, you know, all the 50s, 60s, all the way to, she lived every day of her life with a purpose. And that's, you know, it's inspiring that's, you know, the name that is on our school every day. And the kids are made aware of that, but obviously we tell them that all the time, and it's kind of cool that, you know, unfortunately, you know, now that we're in the news, but when people look her up, they're like, wow, she was something, and hopefully that inspires not only young ladies, but men to again, make a difference. My 9-year-old, I said, is turning 10 this week. She's big into the environment already, and she has little beach patrols and cleanups and everything else.
Aww.
It's awesome. I mean, she's the reason I recycle. I hate to say I wasn't a big recycler, but as soon as she got into it, now I will not let anything touch the garbage can that should be recycled. So there's a 7-year-old influencing a 49-year-old, you know. So it's like, nice.
Well, hey, Dad, let's not pass up this opportunity. It's her birthday next week. So wish her, you're on the radio. Wish her a happy birthday. What's her name?
Luciana.
Luciana, happy birthday.
My baby Lucy, she's turning double digits, and can't wait to celebrate with her next week.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm the father of two fully grown adult women who were dancers. You said
both my girls are dancers. My wife is a dancer, actually, as well.
Yeah, well,
that's awesome. Yeah, my daughter, my friends.
Yeah, my daughter still dances. I can tell you, The closest I've ever come to losing my life, I think, was sitting at my first dance recital when my daughter was about 4 or 5 years old, and she came out in a pink tutu, and she danced around in a circle holding hands with other little girls. And the dance teacher was on the side showing them what to do. And I, because I'm hard of hearing, said in a louder voice than I should have to my wife, "Oh, great. I'm glad we spent all that money to teach her how to walk around a circle."
Oh, cool.
And 10 women turned around and looked at me like, "Don't make us drag you out of here and kick the crap out of you, buddy." Because they were cute. But yeah, my oldest daughter, 28, still dances. So
my wife danced into her 40s. I shouldn't put my age, my wife, on the air right now. But she, she's still dancing into her 40s, which is awesome. And they're the best. I mean, I love going to performances. Like you said, I mean, I cry many, many a time watching them dance, for sure. The recitals and their individual dances are beautiful. So I wore my share of tutus over the years in the house with them and their baby.
Me too.
Well, and I had the opposite with my daughter. When she had her first ballet recital, she looked out at the audience and she ran crying off the stage, never to return again.
And I've seen those ones as well.
She's a complete extrovert. She's a flight attendant now, and she loves people, but that just did it for her. She's like, nope, I'm not in this. I don't want all those eyeballs staring at me.
I'm on a related note, I'm glad it didn't happen at the march, because I was fearful that might happen to a couple of our kids that we picked to talk.
Yeah,
we said before they did.
Yes.
They did a heck of a job.
Yeah, they did a heck of a job.
Walk out and stare at a couple hundred thousand people on the mall and just be like, okay, I'm out, you know?
Yeah.
And all those celebrities.
They spoke from their heart. And like I said, it was a very moving experience for all of us. All of us, even people like me who were just there to be supportive, you know.
I've heard that from a lot of people, and it's awesome to hear.
Yeah, it was just amazing, and we need to see more of it. Well, we're running out of time here, believe it or not. So let me ask you, is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we haven't had a chance to ask you in reference to this stuff? Is there anything else you want to say before we sign off in a few minutes?
No, I've enjoyed the conversation for sure. Like, we've covered a lot of topics, and I mean, I guess.
Yeah, we have.
I just really hope that, like I said before, that, you know, everybody gets a chance to see this book. I mean, if they don't want to buy my book, buy a different book on government. But definitely, I think my book, you know, holds its own and is a great book for anywhere from 3-year-olds to 83-year-olds. And, you know, again, my goal, my mantra is just to get people to participate in politics, from the smallest thing, the easiest thing, to vote, to the most difficult thing, to run for office, as you're aware of, Senator. I mean, anything in between, whether it's petitioning, whether it's marching, whether it's going to rallies, whether it's giving somebody money or joining an interest group. My goal is just to get people to realize that we have control of our own destiny in this nation. And I hope that, you know, we do our part in trying to hold people accountable and pass laws that are going to benefit the masses. That was the goal of the founding fathers. And I hope that, you know, we can get back to that at some point in the next, hopefully tomorrow, but anytime in the next couple of years, I'll be happy with it.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, I think that you sold a couple extra books tonight. My wife is a high school librarian. She has a long-standing relationship with Scholastic, so I wouldn't be surprised if she starts school again in a few weeks if a few copies of your book end up in her library.
We hope
they end up in libraries all across the country. And let me just throw this out to you. Mr. Foster, I have a travel budget and I'm willing to travel. So if the kids at Marjorie Stoneman and Douglas ever want me to come down and talk, if you ever want me to come down and talk, I would be happy to do that. Or we would be happy to host any of your students that come to Washington as well, because I agree 100% with you that the greatest thing about America is that we have the ability to change. But to make that change happen, we have to get involved. You know, Dr. King said that the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. But the rate at which it bends towards justice depends on how many of us are willing to stand up and help temper it. So I think what you're doing is amazing. I thank you for all your hard work and continued success, like I with the kids. And like I say, I'm willing to come down and talk to them anytime.
Well, imagine what you would share with them about D.C. for statehood.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I was. Is the petition being presented this year or now?
Yeah, it passed in the House, actually.
Okay.
As you've already pointed out, our stumbling block is a guy from West Virginia named Joe Manchin. So one person is holding up all the works in the Senate. But that and the filibuster, if we could get the filibuster suspended. But yeah, we're making real progress on the front. Maria, any last questions for Mr. Foster?
No, in the interest of time, I won't, even though I do have many. There wouldn't be a quick answer. But I just want to thank you so much for your time and for you walking the walk and talking the talk. And you're teaching AP government history. So, I mean, you're in rare air with the students that you are instructing, and hopefully that they pass the exam and all. I just think it's wonderful. Thank you for all of that.
We leave the show every week with a song, and we dedicate it to the person, to our guest, usually. And so tonight we're going to leave you with what was an anthem when I was in high school. It was written by a favorite son here in Washington, D.C., Marvin Gaye. And this is a group called Playing for Change, which is young people all over the world participating in this version of Gay's classic, What's Going On? So this goes out to you, Mr. Foster, and all those amazing children that you teach. See you next week.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Thank you. Take good care. And thank you to our listeners for you making us.